The title of our meditation this morning, God's Secretaries, is also the title of a recent book about how the most famous and influential English translation of the Bible came into existence. For the most part, the author goes over familiar ground, except for fascinating glimpses into the personal lives of some of the men who created this version of the Bible over a period of several years. I'd like to share some of those comments along with bits and pieces of information I've used in university classrooms over the years, information which, if I had only known it as a boy, would have made huge changes in my early understanding of both the Bible and religion. The translation Mr. Nicholson writes about, as some of you may have guessed already, is the King James Version of 1611, which for the next 300 years would become not just one among several versions, but for English-speaking Protestants, the only one fully acceptable to them. Most people in those years had no idea how many versions had come before the King James, how many had come afterwards, and how many were still to come, especially the explosion of translations we have experienced in our own 20th century. For them, the King James was the Bible. The language it used was the language God used, and they were highly suspicious of different versions that just did not sound like the real Bible. Most of them had never translated from one language to another and would not have understood why a great literary critic once called all translation the art of failure. He did not mean that there should not be any. After all, few of us could read the Bible in its original Hebrew or Greek, so we would not read the Bible at all if some scholar or group of scholars had not translated it into our own language. What he meant was, and this is very important, that there can never be a perfect translation of any complex piece of literature, especially if much of it is written in poetry, as is true of the Bible. And even if they had heard such a judgment, Christians, and especially fundamentalist Christians, would not have accepted the idea that their King James Version could be anything other than perfect. They rejected change for centuries. And lest you think that I'm talking about the Dark Ages, I remind you that as late as 1952, copies of the excellent Revised Standard Version of the Bible were burned in a Wichita church parking lot because its more accurate translation of a verse from Isaiah weakened their theology about a virgin birth for Jesus. This may be a good moment to remind you that in the strictest sense, none of us has ever seen or touched an original Bible. Not a single book of it exists as it came from the hands of its authors. All the original manuscripts disappeared centuries ago. What we have are translations of copies of copies of copies of those originals. Copies, by the way, which frequently differ from one another in a host of small ways, so that translators always have to decide which copy might be closest to what the author originally wrote, and therefore the one to use while translating. Put 30 different translations of the Bible on a table out in the foyer, and look at them carefully, and you will quickly find that no two of them will be exactly alike. It's hard for me to resist saying more about the problems modern translators face in using these copies, but there's barely enough time to touch on the religious and political battles that led to the making of the King James Version. Some of you, I'm sure, will remember the dueling banjos of a famous movie. Well, as the 17th century began in England, people were passionately divided over what might fairly be called dueling Bibles. Our congregational ancestors, the Puritans, who wanted to move the Anglican Church of England further from its recent Roman Catholic past, liked the Geneva Bible, which had been produced by some of their scholars hiding in Switzerland from persecution in England. The Church of England, still mostly Catholic in all but name, detested this Geneva Bible because of the partisan marginal notes aimed directly at it and at the king, who was now its head instead of the Pope. Puritans, with equal passion, detested the official Bible of the English Church, known as the Bishop's Bible. Something had to be done to promote political and religious harmony, and so in January of 1604, King James agreed with advisors that his new reign should begin by sponsoring a new translation of the English Bible. They would not be starting from scratch, of course. A translation by William Tyndale 100 years earlier and by Miles Coverdale after him would provide more than half of the language the new version would pick up. When King James chose a truly extraordinary group of the finest linguists and biblical scholars in the country, they recognized their debt to earlier translations and would announce in their preface that what they had done was not so much a new translation as a final revision of the previous English Bibles. One of the places I had to see during a sabbatical to England years ago was Hampton Court Palace, where this great endeavor began. I wandered around totally lost in Bible student heaven when I realized suddenly that our 16-year-old son was being impressed for quite different reasons as he looked around the magnificent rooms and the marvelous paintings and was heard to say quietly to himself, "I should have been born a king." I was thinking instead of those 54 formidable minds the king had brought together to create the Bible he hoped would unite his people. They were split into 6 groups of 9 men each, nearly 4 times the size of any earlier effort to translate the Bible. Men like the brilliant Master of Pembroke College, Cambridge, and like the Dean of Westminster, who was not only the greatest preacher of his time, but a remarkable linguist who spoke 15 modern languages and 6 ancient ones. Not surprisingly, this polyglot was in charge of the group that would translate the first 12 books of the Old Testament. There were no lightweights on the committee, though some of them, one would have to confess, were more than a little eccentric at times. One of them, George Abbott, Master of University College, Oxford, once had 140 Oxford undergraduates arrested because they failed to remove their hats when he walked into St. Mary's Church. This story really hit home for me because during two lucky years in Oxford, I used to walk occasionally into the dimness of St. Mary's Church, famous church, and think of the history made in that place. And once, when no one was there, I even ascended the high pulpit where Cardinal John Henry Newman preached and gazed out over some of the most famous empty pews in the world. Back to King James and his committee. Each scholar worked alone on the part assigned to his group before conferring with his other eight colleagues. And when that group finished a book, it was circulated to the other five groups for their input. And since the king wanted a book so majestic and so melodious when read in church that it would unite all the warring parties, a man would read aloud at one of the final meetings while the others judged the spoken beauty of the language they had chosen. And as a result, they ended with the most poetically beautiful of all English Bibles. Not the most accurate, we would learn later as new Greek manuscripts came to light, but beyond question, the most poetic. It was, after all, the pinnacle moment in the history of English literature. The age of Shakespeare, Lyly, Greene, Kidd, Marlowe, Sir Philip Sidney, and others who used the language as no one had used it before, and I really think no one has used it since. But as modern scholars know, in creating such musical language, the committee took liberties often with the manuscripts in front of them, often making more music than existed in the original Hebrew or Greek. This was especially true of their New Testament work. Those books, the New Testament books, were written not in the classical Greek of poetic dramatists like Aeschylus, Sophocles, and Euripides, but in Koine, or common Greek, language used in the street. One example. Remember the parable about a widow who kept begging a heartless judge for help, dogging his footsteps until he finally says he will grant her request, quote, in the King James Version, lest by her continual coming she weary me? Elegantly said, lest by her continual coming she weary me, but in the vivid slang of the original Greek, Jesus has the judge say he'll help this pest so she won't, quote, give him a black eye. Not quite sophisticated enough for the king's committee, so they dressed it up. But they created such melody that to this day, if I want music more than accuracy in quoting the Bible at a wedding or a funeral, I'm likely to use the King James rather than the modern versions, which are closer to the original manuscripts. Now, I have to beg your special patience for a moment. Please fine-tune your ears right now and listen to how that committee turned earlier English translations into better music. The Bishop's Bible had begun the 23rd Psalm this way. God is my shepherd, therefore I can lack nothing. Now that second sentence to me is about as non-musical as language gets. Therefore I can lack nothing. The Puritan's Geneva version, the rival version, did somewhat better. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And where the Bishop's Bible committed this atrocity, he will cause me to repose myself in pasture full of grass. The Geneva did better with, he maketh me to rest in green pasture. Well, the King James scholars unerringly took the most melodious translations and then improved on them, changing rest to lie down and pluralizing pasture so that you came up with, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. That is melody, that is rhythm. No succeeding modern version has ever even approached. But just think, if the High Church Bishop's Bible had prevailed, instead of he maketh me to lie down in green pastures, we would have been saying all this time, he will cause me to repose myself in pasture full of grass. I'm not sure the psalm would ever have become as popular as it is. Try this one. The Puritan's Geneva version has, come unto me, the famous invitation of Jesus, come unto me, all ye that are weary and laden, and I will ease you. The Church of England's Bishop's Version has, come unto me, all ye that labor sore and are laden, and I will ease you. Now here, the King James Committee changed those words into marvelous music. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Now, if your ear for language is as good as Bob Scott's ear for music, you can hear what the single added word heavy does to improve the rhythm and cadence of that famous invitation, making it perfect for reading aloud. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. So one word sums up the lasting legacy of the King James Version. Music. The translators were masters of assonance and alliteration, of rhythm and repetition, and used them to make the Bible sound much more elegant and melodious than it was in most of its original form. You remember Ruth's famous pledge to her mother, often used in wedding ceremonies? Entreat me not to leave thee or to return from following after thee, for whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge, and thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. Now, above my desk at home are versions like the American Standard, the Revised Standard, the New RSV, the Fine Jerusalem, and New American Bibles done especially for Catholics, today's English Version, the New International Version, which rests on the lectern, Phillips, Moffat, Goodspeed, one entitled, believe it or not, the easy-to-read translation, published in Fort Worth and sent to me by a former student of mine who became a missionary in Hungary, and even the Living Bible, which scholars consider the poorest version ever produced in English. So I looked to see how some of these versions had destroyed the King James music of Ruth's promise. Ruth says in today's English version, it's sort of like someone asking to have the cup of coffee refreshed, don't ask me to leave you, let me go with you. The New English Bible has, do not urge me to go back and desert you. The excellent Catholic Jerusalem Bible has, do not press me to leave you and to turn back from your company. And now, having heard that, once more, listen to the music of the King James with the assonance of those four long E sounds. Entreat me not to leave thee. And the alliteration in the phrase, or to return from following after thee. You hear it? Okay, my English professor face is too much in view. But believe me, all this business about musical language has had a vital significance for religious faith in the English-speaking world. You see, as those King James translators knew very well, it's easier to get people to venerate the Bible as the inspired Word of God if its very language so often sounds like divine music. I'm not playing the current game of bashing the Germans and the French, but the truth is, they had nothing comparable in their translations of the Bible. And as a partial result of that, they never made an idol of the Bible in quite the same way so many American fundamentalist Christians do. After all, entreat me not to leave thee, or to return from following after thee, and whither thou goest, I will go, and whither thou lodgest, I will lodge, sounds a great, great deal more like God talking than do not urge me to go back and desert you, or let me go with you, which sounds very much like the neighbor next door. Whether consciously or not, American fundamentalists understood this, which is why so many of them fought so hard to hang on to the King James and reject the modern speech versions, which so much more accurately reflect what was actually written by ancient Jews and Christians. They thought that the King James was idolized, accepted without question from day one as the real Bible. Not so. They had no idea that when an eminent Cambridge scholar saw the brand new King James, he let the king know that he had rather be torn apart by wild horses than allow it to be read in churches, and said he wanted that Bible burned. It's hard sometimes to let go of the familiar. Like many churches still, my childhood church had no idea that what they considered the only true Bible had already been revised repeatedly before they began to read it. Or that, as a great University of Chicago scholar pointed out, the modern King James Version differs from the one first published in 1604 in more than 75,000 details. Final repetition. If you want music, the Shakespearean language of the King James certainly has it. If you want the much clearer and simpler language almost all original authors of the Bible use, then a version like the New Revised Standard is much better. As a missionary to the Philippines wrote to a good friend of mine, it bothers me when I realize how many Filipinos by the King James Version. It is problem enough for them to be learning common English and then to have to wade through archaic language nearly four centuries old. Well, many who wrote the Bible labored above all else to be clear rather than elegant, and the King James simply does not convey that original plainness. And because I feel that the message is so much more important even than the superimposed music, the King James, for the most part, is a cherished museum relic in my own library, not the version I would dream of recommending to a new young convert to the Christian faith. It's finished. Next Sunday, some comments about one of the most troubling and persistent problems in Christian theology, the undeserved suffering of good people in a world said to be created by perfect love. I hope you'll come back.